So did you like feel the feeling of metta? Yes, you did. Some people did. That's good. Excellent. That's very special, isn't it? I remember when that kind of first happened to me and I was meditating, I was first could kind of feel this and I was almost like shocked. I was like, what? It's like other people this happens to, it's not me. Other people feel like this. How can I feel like this? Yeah.
you said, I heard that you said that you that I should imagine myself as the crystal Buddha. Is it?
You're not necessarily imagining, but you just see your body like that. You see your body filled with light. Yeah, you feel it full. Feel it full of light. No. Yeah. You can if you like a vision, but I was thinking like you just feel your body feels like
right.
That. Yeah.
Your vision is a kind of like an exterior.
That's right, it's a different thing, yeah? Different kind of meditation. Thank you for picking up on that. You're paying attention. It's nice to know somebody's paying attention, right? Okay. So one of the things that like learning metta does is it teaches that because it tends to give rise to that feeling of joy quite quickly, then it teaches us that that feeling is there, it's available. Now, as a generalization, what tends to happen with meditation is that with metta meditation, you feel joy quickly and you feel peace later. Whereas with breath meditation, you feel peace right away and then you feel the joy later. It tends to be how it goes. So it's not that one way is better than the other, but they're different and it's useful to have both approaches. Just for the record, one of the reasons why we typically teach metta more generally or more as a kind of basic meditation rather than say compassion meditation, also compassion meditation of course is a wonderful one, but compassion is a little bit more mature as an emotion, right? Metta is a very childlike emotion. It's very simple, right? So you lot are very simple, right? And so I'm teaching you a very simple meditation. Yeah? What I mean by that is that it's the foundation, like compassion. Compassion means, first of all, you have to touch somebody else's suffering. You have to understand what the nature of suffering is to have compassion. And when you do that, you can be very vulnerable, right? If you don't have a sense of groundedness in yourself, then you can over-identify, get drawn into somebody's suffering, right? And that can not be good, yeah? This is not uncommon that this happens. You see it like, say, among activists or carers and these kinds of things, even therapists and so on. And your job is to empathize with other people's suffering. But if you haven't got that basis of love and care for yourself to begin with, you can get dragged into it too much. So this is why we begin with metta, and that solid foundation. Then if you later you want to do compassion meditation, you know, reach out to other suffering, then that's fine. You won't have a problem with that. So anyway, that's just why we usually teach it like that. So metta is there for us all, and it is a way for to bring us happiness and joy in the meditation. And what the Buddha said about joy in meditation, one of the most beautiful phrases that he used is dhammata esa. Yeah? It's only natural. It's only natural that if your mind is free of remorse, that you'll feel... you have a feeling of well-being. It's only natural that if you have a feeling of well-being that you feel joy. It's only natural that if you feel joy that you feel tranquility. It's only natural that if you feel tranquility that your mind will feel experience pleasure. It's only natural that if your mind has pleasure then it will become still and will become immersed in samadhi. It's only natural that if your mind becomes immersed in samadhi that it will see things as they really are. It's only natural that if you see things as they really are, you'll let go of them. It's only natural that if you let go of them, you'll find peace. It's only natural. It's that easy. There's nothing to it. There's literally nothing to it. That's why it's called emptiness, right? Yeah. So these, and the simile the Buddha gave for this, it's like when the rains fall on the mountaintops and they fill up the little puddles, and the little puddles overflow into little rivulets, and the rivulets overflow into little creeks, and the creeks flow into streams, and the streams flow into rivers, and the little rivers flow into the great rivers, and the great rivers flow down to the ocean. Isn't this such a beautiful simile? You think about that. Think about how that works and how that spiritual progress goes. And that's when you understand that you can't, like so often in our spiritual practices, it's as if we've got a little creek, and we jump into the creek and we try to push the water faster. Flow faster, flow faster. Actually, the creek's doing fine. It's all doing fine. The water's going down. See, this guy is flowing down the hill. Everything's going fast. Faster, faster, faster. We want to get to Nibbana quicker. So it's not up to you. It's not your job to make it all happen. It's not your job to make your mind peaceful. It's not your job to make your mind happy. It's your job to get out of the way and let it happen. So there are many things that we can do. We can do, there's many like tips and tricks that I could talk about, and things that we can do that can help to sort of spark a bit of joy and make us feel a bit happy in the meditation. And you can see some of those things in the way that we're doing this retreat and in the way that I'm sort of trying to hold this retreat. You know, like I do things like I sort of crack some jokes, right? And I do this for two reasons. One is because I'm pathetically insecure and I want you to like me. But more importantly, more importantly, because it breaks the mood, because it makes us not think, feel so seriously about things. Yeah. I remember one time when I was in Ajahn Brahm's monastery at Bodhnyana, and many of you, of course, you know Ajahn Brahm, you know he likes to crack jokes and things like that. But actually, the funniest Dhamma talk that I ever went to was not by Ajahn Brahm, but by another monk, Venerable Guttasila. And it wasn't even trying to be that funny or really, but it kind of ended up that way. I happened to be on a month-long retreat at that time. I was just staying in my hut by myself, and I literally didn't see a single person that whole time. And the only time to come out from the retreat was for the weekly Dhamma talk. So I came out for the Dhamma talk, and Ajahn Brahm was also on retreat, so then he got this other monk to give the talk while he was on retreat. And Guttasila is like, he's not a real kind of Dhamma speaker, right? It's not his kind of thing. So he really just gave a few kind of anecdotes about his life as a monk and all of the funny things that happened to him. And, you know, which included the place where he used to go for alms round in Sri Lanka. And like through walking through the jungle, there were like so many leeches that it felt like walking on spaghetti. And so anyway, he kept on telling all these different kinds of stories, and we ended up laughing a lot. And, you know, even though I was in the middle of a month-long retreat, and at that time, you know, your mind gets very peaceful and your mindfulness gets very sharp, and you go along and it's quite raucous to kind of sit with a bunch of people and just kind of laughing. I mean, it's raucous, relatively raucous, I mean, for monks, it's not that raucous. But the best meditation I had on that retreat was when I came back from that talk, you know, and just came back and I just sat meditation and it just happened. Like my mind just goes, everything happened just like it's supposed to happen. Like, wow, because I wasn't so attached to it. I wasn't like, you know, there's always this kind of subtle feeling of like, you know, how can I get there? How, you know, is this one going to get better? And it's just very relaxed. This is how meditation goes. Often you find that the best meditation will be like the day after the retreat. Because during the retreat there's always a bit of a feeling of wanting to get something and have something. So take advantage of these things, and the other things that's like doing a bit of work and a bit of service, helping each other out, all of these things, these are things, ways of making, bringing joy to your mind, giving things away, giving things up. And that kind of happiness, that kind of response of happiness, is what will lead your mind to peace. We've actually got a big bunch of questions here, so I might have a look at some of these. And we'll see how we go. Okay, so somebody says, I know the point of the Buddha's meditation is to clear your mind, but is it okay to focus on a mantra internally and chant on the inside? Yes, it is, absolutely. I'm asking this because in a way it seems like wishing or praying for something which maybe seems in opposition to the Buddha's teachings. No, that's fine to do some mantra or something. I think it's very common. Most forms of Buddhist meditation use some kind of meditation word or something like that to keep your mind focused. So that's absolutely fine. Sometimes insight feels like unlearning things that I had taken for granted. To what extent do you find truth in this? Yes, very much so. And not only is insight unlearning the things you take for granted, insight also means unlearning the things you learnt in Buddhism. Yeah, and this is the biggest opposition to people, biggest obstacle to people getting insight in Buddhism is actually learning Buddhism. Seriously. Yeah. Krishnamurti used to talk about freedom from the known, because you think you know everything, you know, and you know, when I mean, it's different in different places and with different people. One of the things that I ended up saying, especially when I went to Sri Lanka, when I'm talking to people about meditate, I tell them, don't meditate in Pali. Don't meditate in Pali. Because they're all coming and talking to me about, oh, you know, I had this jhana, or I had this vitaka, or I had this piti, or I had this. It's all kind of about, like, how does their experience fit into this technical category? Is this this, or is this that, or is this that, or is this correct, or is this that? It's your experience. Live it. Your experience isn't correct or incorrect. It's your life, right? Know it. The whole point of Buddha's teachings is to point us to our experience, not so that we can sort of categorize it in some Pali term or something like that. And so we go in there and we think we know, and we think we understand all of these things, and we interpret and we read all of our experiences. And what in fact we're doing is we're wrapping our experiences in boxes and we're keeping it safe. Because we're too scared to actually see things for ourselves. And if I can explain it away in terms of some doctrine or some idea, or I can make it agree with some teacher's teaching or something like that, then that's good. I feel validated because my experience is right. Your experience isn't right. Your experience is life. It's not right or wrong. It just is. So the purpose of the teachings is to illuminate that, to point to it, to encourage it, to give us some perspective for understanding it, but not so we can wrap up our experience and explain it away, oh, this is this, this is that. So when you're meditating, unlearn everything and do not try to sort of classify and understand what your experience is. And again, you know, I mentioned yesterday one of the trade secrets of a meditation teacher. When I'm listening to people talk about meditation, I want to hear how clearly they talk about it. But the other thing that I listen for is if somebody starts talking to me about their meditation in terms of some doctrinal category. And as soon as somebody does that, then I know this person is not they're not experiencing their meditation anymore. Don't come and tell me, I've got this jhana, or I've got this, or I've got that. I don't care what you think you've got. I want to know what your experience is. Yeah? Can you tell me your experience? So this is the purpose. This is why. Like, if you look at the Buddha's, especially the Buddha's wisdom teachings, right? So much of the Buddha's wisdom teachings is phrased in a negative form, right? It's impermanent, right? It's not self. Everything's about something isn't something. This is why the Buddha does that, right? Because that's how you break down these things. As soon as you start talking in terms of positive things, this is this, this is that, this is that, then you've got some construction that you have to fit your mind into. So the Buddha's saying, no, get rid of all that, get rid of that, deconstruct it. Okay, is bodhicitta the mind's natural state? All right. Unperturbed or something by ignorance. Is bodhicitta the mind's natural state unperturbed by ignorance? No. No? What do you think it is? Tell you more. Well, is that still keeping a vow of silence? If you, I don't know. That's one for the vineyard experts. Okay. Okay. So, do you guys know what bodhicitta is? Anyone know what bodhicitta is? Go on. Yes, slightly less briefly.
The aspiration to attain awakening for the benefit of all beings.
Thank you. That's like literally word for word what I was hoping to get. Yeah, very good. Okay. So bodhicitta is a true. That's right. Very good. The bodhicitta is a concept or an idea which is very prominent in Mahayana. I'm not a Mahayanist, so I don't really know all that much about it, although I've got a general kind of familiarity with it. The reason why I would say confidently it's not that mind's natural state, I touched upon this yesterday, but the idea is the mind doesn't have a natural state. The mind just is, it's just conditioned. It has all kinds of different states, and there's no kind of mind that exists before ignorance. Ignorance is just part of the state and part of the process that the mind's in. The Buddha often compared the mind to water, for example. So ask yourself, what's water's natural state?
Transparent,
okay, unless it's snow, in which case it's not transparent. I mean, is water's natural state a liquid? Or gas, or solid, actually it's all three of those states. Is water naturally pure? Well, it is if it's in a cloud.
No smell, no color.
No smell, unless of course it's a stagnant water in a creek that smells, then that's naturally smelly. Point being that water exists in nature in all kinds of different conditions. There's no such thing as the abstract idea of water, H2O, separate from all of those conditions, is purely an abstraction invented by chemists. It doesn't exist. It's just an idea that chemists come up with to help them understand how the world works. There's no such thing in the world of just H2O. Yeah. So water's natural state is to be conditioned. Natural state is to be affected by temperature and by other things that's in it and by the movement and all of those things. That's the natural state of water, and the mind's the same. So, yeah. Oh, incidentally, while we're on the topic of bodhicitta, give a bit of a plug for my mate Yeshi's foundation, the Bodhicitta Foundation. You know, some of you met Ayeshe was here before. Did anyone meet Ayeshe when she was here? No? Okay, well, you all missed out. Hopefully you can get her back sometime. And she's a very dear friend of mine, one of my Dhamma sisters, and she runs an organization in India called the Bodhicitta Foundation. You can find it on the web. And she lived in India, in Maharashtra for many years with the ex-Dalit community. So these are people who were part of what we call the outcast community, or the Dalit community, who converted to Buddhism. And they are lifting themselves up, lifting themselves out of the slums. And Yeshe's done amazing work there to help people out. Really, really incredible people. So I do, and the work they're doing is amazing. I met a few of her students and a few of the people from her group. I remember one young girl who was from her group. We met her at Bodh Gaya. She was maybe, I don't know, 16 or something like that. And, you know, we were talking with her about her life and things like that. And she was saying she's brought up in the slums in India, in Maharashtra. It's one of the poorest states, one of the poorest regions. And they had a big family just in one tin shack. The father didn't have any, his father lost his job, didn't have any work. He used to come home drunk, he used to beat his wife, he used to beat the kids. And that's all they ever knew. And they just grew up like that. And she was talking about how that was her life. And she encountered the Dhamma, encountered Sister Yeshe, who helped her out, taught her skills, gave her an education. And she's 16 years old now, and she said, I said, you know, what do you want to do? She said, I want to go to university, get a social worker's degree, so I can help people like me. And that's bodhicitta. Yeah, it's such an amazing thing for someone in that situation. It wasn't like a trace of like victimhood or anything like that in her, you know. She just knew where she'd come from, and she knew what was going on so clearly, and all she wanted to do was help to make sure that other people didn't have to go through that. Yeah. Anyway. Irina. Bodhicitta is what makes someone a bodhisattva. When you have the bodhicitta, I think that's right, isn't it? When you have the bodhicitta, you become a bodhisattva. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So I'm dealing with chronic illness. I am sorry to hear that. I hope that you are not suffering too much. I found it helpful at times to release expectations and attachments to feeling well or feeling like my old self. At the same time, of course, I want to be in better health, and it would help me to be of service. How do you reconcile these feelings or seek healing without attachment? So, I mean, don't make a problem out of it, right? If you feel sick, then get healing, right? The Buddha did, right? When the Buddha was sick, he went to see a doctor. He didn't say, I'm going to let go of the body. You go and see the doctor, but you know that sometimes it's not going to help, or sometimes it might only, you know, it might help a little bit, but you do what you can anyway. Yeah? The Buddha said that in the case of sickness, there can be three different conditions. One is that if you're treated, you get better, and if you're not treated, you don't get better. Right? Fair enough. The other one is if you go and see a doctor, you don't get better anyway, whether you're treated or not, you're not going to get better. The other case is when you are going to get better anyway, no matter what you do, you're going to recover. So no matter which one of those three cases you are, you should always get treatment, because you never know. I think the Buddha, perhaps they lived in more naive times. Now we need a fourth case, is when you do get better if you don't get treatment, but you don't get better if you do get treatment. We live in more complicated times, right? So that's the idea. So don't worry about it. Don't make it complicated, and don't overthink it. Yeah, look after yourself, and you know, also just one thing, just to note and just to remember. And I spoke with this with a few people when I was in a few people in Sydney, but also a few people about this when I was in California as well. And it's one of the things that we have not really developed very well in the Buddhist community, especially Western Buddhist community, is developed that idea of kind of pastoral care and of looking after each other as part of a spiritual community. And when we kind of do it sometimes on a kind of ad hoc basis, you know, like as monks or nuns, we might go and visit someone in a hospital or something like that. And some people do more of it. I'm aware that there are some people who do that. But I think that's also something that we can maybe like think about as spiritual communities. That if there's, you know, we're all our family and we're all here to help each other. So if one of our family is sick, then, you know, let us know. And, you know, we can see maybe there's something we can do to help. Yeah, maybe just drop by and see how you're going from time to time, or, you know, maybe help with a meal or something like that. You know, so give you a lift to the hospital if you need it or something like that. So, you know, just sort of putting that out there as something that I think should be part of what we do as a spiritual community, remembering that the Buddha said that one who would care for me would care for the sick. So this is something that... Do you know about that story? There was in the monastery at one time, one of the monks was sick and had dysentery. He was lying in his bed and all of the other monks just left him. And then the Buddha said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, he's useless." The other monks said, "He's useless. We're not going to look after him." So the Buddha said, if that was me, I'd be like, "What? What the hell have I been doing this whole time? What a waste of time have I been doing with you bloody idiots? Get out of here." But anyway, I'm not the Buddha, obviously. So what the Buddha did was call Venerable Ananda, and they came and they cleaned the monk out, they lifted him from his bed, they put him in a clean place and gave him clean dressing, and he looked after him himself. And that's what he said to the monks. He said, "Look after each other, take care of each other. And if you would look after me, then look after the sick." Okay. Ajahn Brahm talks about the beautiful breath. Goenkaji talks about the soft breath like a fine thread. How to make the best use of this? Is this a portal to deep absorption states? If so, what's the process? Crikey. Well... yeah, I mean, these are similar kind of ways of talking about it, and you know, this is what these teachers are doing. And like another one who has a kind of distinctive teaching is Ajahn Gunha in Thailand, and he has this his thing is sabai. So do you know any Thai? Do you know what sabai means? No, in Thai, sabai is very famous. You know what sabai means? No, sabai means like relax. You know, yeah. Sabai, relax, breathe in, relax, breathe out, relax. So this is basically his whole meditation teaching, right? Sabai, breathe in, sabai. it works better in Thai than in English, because like in Thailand it's like, it's not just a word, it's like a lifestyle, right? You've got to sabai, take it easy. So what all of these teachers are doing when they're teaching like this is that they're trying to find some way to create an emotional connection with the breath. That's the key. Create an emotional connection with the breath. The breath isn't just air. The breath is part of you. And so rather, we have this way of looking at it. We think it's just kind of a physical thing or material thing or something like that. So you have to feel it. And you think of the way the Buddha talked about it. You're experiencing, breathing in, experiencing joy. Breathing out, experiencing joy. Breathing in, experiencing pleasure. Breathing out, experiencing pleasure. It's a very emotional experience. And so these are just different ways of talking about it. It's going to help you with that and help you connect with that breath. So, these are kind of skillful means. But it's also something which is a bit deeper than that. I mean, this is not just something that's incidental to the practice of breath meditation. It's fundamental to it. Until we find that deep level of emotional connection with the breath, we won't find that deep sense of peace which is leading us to samadhi. Yeah. So is this the portal or the path to deep absorption states? Absolutely it is. Yeah, this is the path to jhana. This is how you do it. The deeper and the closer that your emotional connection is with the breath or with metta or whatever else it is. What it's doing is it's unifying your mind. It's bringing everything together. And the more deep and the more relaxing your sense of pleasure is, the longer you'll sit there. And the more stillness you'll realize. So they're asking about what's the process. I'm not sure how much detail to go into. I might leave that for now. I've talked a bit about it in general terms, but I might leave it for now. If we may have some time to talk more about it later. Can you explain what physical difficulties the Buddha had dealt with in his life? Oh my goodness. Well, he had a bad back for a start. And so he used to, when he was giving Dhamma talks, he used to say, oh, I've got a bad back, I'll just have a bit of a lie down. So he'd just lie down in front of everyone and have a rest while in the middle of a Dhamma talk. I'm like, he's got such self-confidence, right? Right? I mean, I'd just feel weird. Excuse me, I'll just have a... Right, so bad back, and he used to sit out in the sun and just sort of let the sun warm his back. He got, he had dysentery sometimes. I mean, I think generally speaking, he had pretty good health. You know, we don't hear that often about the Buddha getting sick, but he definitely did get sick, and the sutta's going to make a point of it. You know, he wasn't a divine being. He was subject to these kinds of things. He was injured by Devadatta throwing the stone at him. So, I mean, I think generally speaking, it seems that he had pretty good physical health. Of course, he was living quite an active lifestyle, and much of his life was wandering around. And still, even right at the end of his life, Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he was 80 years old, and he's just wandering through the jungles and the forests of northern India. So, you know, good on him, right? Yeah. So, how did he and other disciples cope with extreme physical pain? Well, basically through meditation. And the Buddha, in fact, explicitly says this in the suttas, that when his body's very sore because he's getting old, then the only way that he can escape from that, he said his body's like an old cart which is held together by being strapped up. And the only way you can get free of all that pain is in deep meditation. You mentioned the Buddha was in a lying down posture frequently. How best to meditate in the horizontal position? Well, it's a good idea to practice like that when you're going to sleep. So when you lie down, you go to bed, you can just watch your breath, or just do some metta as you're going to sleep. And just do that, and that will help you to sleep more peacefully and help you to sleep more easily. Yeah? Much better than like Xanax or whatever people take. But if you want to try, sometimes, especially when you're on a long retreat, like sometimes your body does get a bit sore from sitting all the time, and you know, because of the weather here, it's a bit cold, it's a bit hard to get outside to do a lot of walking meditation. So I understand it's kind of, you feel like sometimes you want to sort of stretch out and lie down. So you can do that. Of course, the problem is you're likely to fall asleep. So that's really the trick, isn't it? To be able to lie down without sort of losing your mindfulness. If you can do that, one way you can do that is just to do it for a short period. So you can just maybe even set a timer or something, just do it for 10 minutes or something, give you time to relax. Some people can do it without falling asleep. There's a story of a monk who was a student of Ajahn Chah's who went away on a long retreat, long solo retreat by himself, and he was known as being quite a dedicated meditation monk. And then when he came back to the monastery, the monks would see him all the time because they have these huts, and then underneath the hut there's like an open space, and he had a little cot there, and he would be just lying down on this cot the whole time. And the monks were like, wow, this monk used to be really dedicated, he used to meditate a lot. And then they asked him, you know, what are you doing lying there? And he said, nothing. They said, don't you fall asleep? He said, sleeping is something. Make of that what you will. Okay, dear Bhante, how to develop a better relationship with pain? Okay, and just so we're clear, pain is like heavily bolded, capital and underline. Okay. Especially chronic pain. I'm somewhat aware, but I can't remain equanimous when working on those sensations. Well, I am, again, I'm sorry to hear that, and, you know, I think it's useful for all of us to know, to understand that other people who are sitting here are sometimes suffering. You know, maybe you might be flying away on clouds of ecstasy with every meditation, but other people are going through their stuff, yeah? And, yeah, sometimes it can be a bit of a struggle. So, yeah, I feel you, and I hope you can get through it. What I would suggest dealing with a lot of pain in meditation can be a hassle, and it can be something that's quite distracting from your practice, right? Because you just want to sit there and be peaceful, and then this pain is coming. So what I suggest as a general rule, it's a practice that you can use is a switching of attention, right? So partly paying attention to the pain and then partly ignoring the pain, okay? So if you're sitting down and you feel that pain coming up, then focus on it for a while. And you decide, okay, this pain is coming up, it's too annoying, I'll focus on it. And so you pay attention. And you just focus on it and watch it as closely as you can. And when you watch that pain as closely as you can, then you tend to find it kind of breaks up a bit. Like you kind of look for it and you say, well, you can't actually locate it sometimes. It sort of disappears, it becomes empty. And sort of you're kind of looking in there and so you realize by watching it that it's not actually quite as scary as you thought. And there's not as much to it as you thought, because a lot of it is actually the fear in the mind. So you do that for a while, maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Then you stop. And then you make a determination in your mind, now I'm going to ignore that pain. And you come and you watch your breath or whatever other meditation you're doing. And you do that. Why do you do that? Because if you're just paying attention to the pain, what happens is that the pain gets its subtle hooks in your brain and in your mind. You somehow get attached to it. You think, here I am observing the pain, but actually you can't let it go. And the pain has control of you. So you need to be able to say this to the pain, okay, it's all right, I can look at you, I'm not afraid, I'm going to watch the pain, but also that's enough. Now I'm going to look somewhere else. Yeah? And the pain is not the boss of you. The pain is not telling you where you're going to focus your attention. You're going to decide, and sometimes you watch the pain and sometimes you won't. Hi. Come in. It's cold. All right. So this is the point about this, is to take back control. Don't let the pain be your master. Right? Pain's just signals coming to your brain or whatever. It's not actually that important. So pay attention for a while. When you've paid attention, you feel that sense of fear is gone, you feel equanimity about it, then you say, okay, now I'll set it aside, and you come back and you do your meditation. If the pain comes back, then and if it's too distracting, then you say, okay, now I'll watch the pain again, but you decide for a period of time, and then you decide, I'm going to come back. All right? Alrighty, so you mentioned that we shouldn't fight our thoughts. There seems to be a fine line between allowing them without getting caught up and trying to push them away. I find that I go into a sort of trance state when I don't fight the thoughts. Is this what you mean by letting go? Oh, I don't really know. Trance state's a kind of vague description, but as long as you're mindful, that's okay, right? That's the main thing. As long as you're mindful, are you really aware of what's going on? When I'm saying don't fight the thoughts, well, one thing you can do is just if you find that the thoughts are too much and they're still coming and they're too distracting, then just have a look where the thoughts are coming from. Okay? So just sort of, oh, where's that coming from? Yeah? See, normally we get distracted by the things and we forget about the space. You think about this room, right? There's a lot of people in this room now. You say, actually, this room's, you know, it's not completely full or crowded, but it's somewhat full. But actually there's so much space in this room. Above everybody's heads, it's all empty. In between people, it's all empty. Like even inside the atoms of your body, it's all empty. Yeah? There's so much emptiness in this room. And yet when you walk into the room, all you see is the people. See, this is the problem. We think that the thoughts are so important because they're grabbing our attention. But imagine what this room would be like if there was no space. Right? I mean, we're talking like the trash compactor scene from Star Wars here. Right? It would not be pretty. Yeah? So it's the space that makes the people possible. We couldn't be here, we couldn't exist, we couldn't live without that space. It's the same thing in your mind. Without the space in your mind, the thoughts aren't possible. So don't, this is why the idea is like, don't give too much importance to those thoughts. Just because they're flashy, just because they're noisy. Pay attention to the space between them. There's a famous pianist who said this. Maybe it was Leonard Bernstein or someone like that. And he said, what is it that distinguishes your playing from everybody else? He said, well, the notes I play the same as everyone else. But the spaces, the silence, that's special. Okay. What are the four unfathomables to an unenlightened human's mind? I heard this once, but I couldn't recall it. The four unfathomables. I guess probably thinking of the four anchinteya. Would that be right? I guess so. So I think there's four things. I'm not sure if I can remember them now. Four things that you can't recall. One is the, I think, Buddha Visaya, the range of the Buddhas. One is the Jhana Visaya, is the scope of jhanas. Now, a Kama Visaya is the scope of karma and cause and effect. And what's the other one?
The you are the being in all the universe.
Maybe.
That's it.
I can't recall. Hi. Okay, so I'm not sure. Do you know Irina? Sorry? With the Buddha. I think it's Buddha we say. I'm not sure if there's an Arahant. Maybe.
It's the four things that only a Buddha can know.
Right, yeah. Kama, Jhana. Anyway, we're not 100% sure, but if it's still bothering you at the end of the retreat, come and see us and we'll look it up on Sutta Central, okay? Alright. Okay. So the point with those things is not that you can't understand them, but that the scope of them is really sort of unknowable, like the full scope and full implications of it. So we can know it from a practical point of view, but you can't necessarily know everything about it. Are there any other Buddhist practices ideal for the terminally ill, also for patients with early stage dementia? Oh, not an easy one. So patients with early stage dementia, I have to admit I don't have any experience with that. You know, the only thing that I would say is, you know, probably just kind of ordinary advice is keep somebody active, keep somebody engaged. It's difficult to say also without knowing if somebody already has a spiritual practice. If someone's been a meditator, then obviously it's good to sort of get them doing that. But I'm not sure if it's going to be possible to introduce someone to meditation at that time. You can certainly try it if they're interested. Again, if someone's terminally ill, it's a bit hard to say because, you know, people who are terminally ill are very different. They can be very different kinds of conditions and situations. Obviously, it's great if you can get them to meditate, and if you can spend time with people and encourage them and support them to meditate or read Dhamma or something like that. Traditionally, often people will like play chanting tapes and things like that to remind them of the Dhamma in that time. But it really just depends on the person. Sometimes it's better just to leave people alone in peace, you know, and a bit of kind of support and that kind of thing. And I remember one time I had a family in Sydney that I was quite close to, and the father of the family was dying of cancer, and the whole family was doctors. And so they came to me and they said, look, Madhuma is in denial, right? Whenever any of us try to talk about the fact that he's going to die, he sort of doesn't seem to want to know. And so I said, can you come and talk to him? And so I went to see him. And he said, of course I know I'm going to die. I'm not stupid, I'm a doctor, right? But these people are always so depressing. They want to come to talk. I want someone to come and tell me a joke, you know? And what he actually said was that the only one who had made him laugh was this another monk in Sydney, Venerable Tejadhamma, who had sort of come to see him, because they'd known each other for years as well, and they told funny stories and joked and laughed, and it made him happy. Yeah. Whereas all his family and everyone, you go there, and everyone to be very serious and bring some flowers and be very respectful. If everything is conditioned, how does one progress on the path? If everything is conditioned, one progresses on the path in a conditioned manner. if it wasn't conditioned, how would you progress on the path? I don't want to take a question not seriously, but I don't quite get it. Like the path is the condition for Nibbana. If there's still a problem there or whatever, then come and see me or something like that. But yeah. Anyway, when doing walking meditation, do we focus on sensations? You can if you like. Do we practice anapana when doing walking meditation? You can if you like. How to avoid jumping all over the place? Don't be a monkey in your past life. I guess you probably meant like in the meditation, like jumping all over the place. I guess. So, the way you do that is you make sure that when you're doing the walking meditation, that you have the beginning and the end of the walking path is there to check and to stop. So when you reach the end of the walking path, you stop and you check your mind, you make sure that you're mindful. Then turn around and check your mind again when you're starting. And before you start, you make sure that you're mindful before you begin. And you come to the end and then stop. That's why the walking path is always a straight line and not a circle. Right? So a circle, I just keep on going. Right? So it's a straight line, so you stop at either end. So for walking meditation, paths can be different kind of lengths, and obviously we don't always have a choice in that, but typically it's about 30 to 40 paces, and typically when doing walking meditation, it's usually like a little bit slower than normal walking pace, but not necessarily like super slow or anything like that. But the number of paces in the path doesn't necessarily matter all that much. When I was in Thailand, I was staying in a hut in the forest by myself for a year, and they built a walking path for me there. And when they finished the walking path, the workers were still there finishing off, and then I walked down the path to pace it out and see how many paces it was. You know, it was like whatever it was, 37 paces or something. And then one of the workers who was there just sort of casually said, "Oh, how many steps is that?" I said, "37 steps." He said, "Oh, okay." Now, I didn't think anything of it. And a couple of weeks later, I was going for alms rounds. So at that place, that village, I'd go for alms rounds. So I'd take my bowl and walk around the village and people would give you food. Now, I've been going around this village for, maybe 6 months or something, right, every day. And usually when you do that, you don't necessarily have a conversation with everybody when you go in. I mean, you might say a few words sometimes, but most of the time people just put some food in and you move on. Occasionally you might say something. So this time when we went there, so somebody put the food in my bowl and he says to me, "Excuse me, Bhante," he said, "how old are you?" I told him my age, and that's kind of odd, and moved on. And so when I get back, And then what I learnt was that that worker, when I told him the number of the path, he'd gone and bought steps on the path. He'd gone and bought a lottery ticket, and he'd won. Right? Yeah, it's bad, isn't it? Yeah. And so he said to my friend, who was the owner of the hut I was staying in, he said, "Oh, that monkey, that Western monkey we've got there, he's got really good at giving lottery numbers." So, yeah, obviously word had got round, so that they're now, and they were asking me for these magic numbers. Anyway, what am I saying? The trials and tribulations of being a monk. But they said the same thing about Ajahn Chah when he was in a coma. Because our teacher of our lineage, Ajahn Chah, was in a coma for nearly 10 years, and he used to get a masseur used to volunteer to come down from Bangkok to just give him a massage and turn him over and things like that. And one of the monks said to him one time, he said, "You know, this is really great merit that you're making for coming down all this way, looking after Ajahn Chah like this." And the fellow just laughed and said, "Not really." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I just come for the lottery numbers." He said, "What?" He said, "Ajahn Chah's in a coma. He hasn't said a word for 10 years. Oh no, I can see him twitch. I'm like, count the twitches." Oh dear. What can I say? All right. So, what would be your advice to a person that has to do, notice the phrasing of this, has to do a small bad thing / white lie to achieve something worthy for the common good? What would be my advice? Obviously, this question is intended purely hypothetical. Someone's got a friend who wants to do a small bad thing. This example sort of comes up a lot, and the thing about it is that almost invariably there are ways to do what you need to do without actually lying. Right? There are ways of phrasing things that are sort of polite. If you need to avoid hurting someone's feelings, that you can say something, you know, nice and polite or something like that, and you know, you don't actually have to lie to them. So I'll give you an example from the suttas, and so this is from the story of, from the Vinaya actually, from the story of Yasa. And long story short, Yasa left his home and came to see the Buddha, and the Buddha taught him, and he became a stream enterer, the first stage of enlightenment. But Yasa's dad was missing him, and he'd gone out from the palace, and they sent all the search parties out to look for their son. It was not like a young boy, like he was a grown man, but they were still going out looking for him. And when Yasa's dad comes along, then the Buddha says to Yasa, "Okay, just stay there." And so the Buddha used his psychic powers and made Yasa go invisible. And so Yasa's dad comes along and says, "Have you seen my son?" So what does the Buddha say? Right? The Buddha says, "Well, why don't you sit here and then maybe you'll see him." Right? So he's not lying to him. Yeah? And while he's sitting there, then he teaches him the Dhamma. And when he's understood the Dhamma, he says, "Okay," so he says, "Here's your son. He was here all along." Yeah? So this is the kind of way that you can do. You can always find another way, almost always. But look, you know, do I think it's a good idea to be telling white lies and things like that? No. It's better to be honest. But is it like the worst thing in the world to tell a white lie occasionally? No, it's not. So, I don't know. But, you know, for myself, if I'm going to die in 5 minutes, I'd rather have been telling the truth to the people around me and the people I know rather than lying to them. I don't know. All right. Yes, it does get easier. Just keep at it. Affirm it's the most joyful thing. Metta. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you for that. That was an affirmation. That was a bit of a pick-me-up for all of us. Thank you. Okay, does this path have an end? What? That's not funny. No, you're just laughing at random things. I don't know. Is that funny? I don't know. Does this path have an end, or ultimately lead to being a monastic? Or what is the likelihood of a lay practitioner reaching enlightenment? Like you're talking about statistics? Probabilities? Okay, a few things I can say. There's a 0% likelihood that anybody who's attached to the idea of being a layperson or the idea of being a monastic is going to get enlightened. So the point really is that, you see, life is kind of short and kind of a hassle, and then you die, right? And that's basically all there is to it. So if we're going to live, then why not live in a way that opens up some kind of possibility for something better? And to me, this is like what the kind of the symbol or the ideal of the Sangha is. And exactly what that means, well, it's a bit hard to pin out, right? It's totally different for anybody. But it's something, it's like that idea, oh, maybe there's something else. Maybe there's like a higher value. Maybe there's another way. Right? And so one of the things that we offer in the Buddhist community is that possibility to take that step and to take that commitment. Now remember that, this is a social and a cultural institution. It has its own histories. It's not perfect by any means, right? The Buddhist monastic order is very far from perfect. And, we can, talk for ages about all the different problems that we have with monastic life and Sangha life and everything like that. But at the end of the day, you're doing something which is what the Buddha set up and said, look, if you want to practice for enlightenment, these are things that this is the best way we can do it. This is the best way that the Buddha set up to organize it. So this is why it's really helpful and really supportive. And one of the things that does, especially in the times of the Buddha, it gives people opportunities that they wouldn't necessarily have. Okay? So obviously if somebody is rich, then they can probably make a hut for themselves and go off and meditate or something like that. But if somebody doesn't have the finances to do that, they don't have the economic opportunities to do that, how are you going to do it? You can't take the time off work because you don't have any food, right? And especially opportunities for women. And in the Buddha's day, the roles and the opportunities for women were limited. Most of the professions were, from the normal accounts given in the suttas and things like that, most of the professional work and trades was done by men. Women were mostly living in the home, housewives and so on. Not to say that women were completely limited to those roles, but mostly in the society of the time, it seems that that's what the options were. And so having a monastic order available for women meant that there was that opportunity to be actually respected and supported and have that ability to live and make your choices about how you're going to live and how you're going to live your life. So this was something which is offered there as an opportunity for being able to live a life dedicated to the Dhamma. But it's a vocation, and it should be something that you can maybe question and say, well, is this going to be good? And the fact of the question is already something there, because then that helps you to reflect on your own life, right? How am I living? What am I doing? And for most people, you live your life. Don't worry about it. Right? It's okay. And just do the best you can. But there's so many things that we can learn, and one of the things I think is really interesting for us to share as monastics is to talk about the Vinaya, and to talk about how the Vinaya works in terms of building community, and the decision-making procedures, and all of the kinds of things which is built into the way that the Vinaya and the monastic code works. I was invited years ago. I was invited to give a talk at a business seminar, how to mindfulness in a corporation or something like this. And I'm like, dude, I don't know anything about corporations. How can I go and do that? And then I realized, I'm actually a member of the world's oldest, largest, and most successful multinational corporation. Right? Okay. How is the concept of rebirth explained in Buddhism? I can't seem to accept it. I can't seem to accept it as it is not scientifically proven. Okay, so fair enough. If you don't think that the science proves it, that's fine. But the idea in Buddhism is that... it's a big topic, right? I don't know how much I can sort of go into it in one little bit. But the way to think about it in terms of Buddhism is that in terms of like energy and information transfer, that's basically the idea. So Bhante Gunaratna came up a number of years ago with the simile of the fax machine, which is actually a very good simile. Unfortunately, people don't know what fax machines are anymore. It was like a really cutting-edge simile when he came up with it. Hey, does everyone know what a fax machine is? Yeah? You've got some younger people. You know what a fax machine is? Have you seen one?
Yeah.
You've seen one. Okay, very good. Everyone, we're good with fax machines? Okay. So with a fax machine, you start out with a piece of paper like this, right? And so the piece of paper has some information on it, right, in the form of letters. Then you put the piece of paper into the fax machine and it gets scanned, it gets converted into some binary data or something, and the binary data is then transferred over the wire to another fax machine. And then the other fax machine has a blank sheet of paper, prints out the blank sheet of paper with the same thing as on the original one. Okay? Now, notice a few things about that. Point number one, not one single atom goes from this fax machine to that fax machine. Right? Nothing is transferred. Okay? Point number two, the actual details of the sheet of paper on the other fax machine are not the same as this one. Right? I mean, there's always imperfections and so on, right? The actual, it's different color and all of that stuff. But the information is the same. The words are the same. The meaning of the words is still the same. So what actually has transferred? Well, what's transferred is patterns. Patterns of information. Patterns of information coded as energy. That's what's actually transferred. So this, what we think of as a piece of paper, actually this is just patterns of energy. This is just structured molecules and atoms in kind of lattices and things like that moving together. And these are just different ways of refracting light and so on, the different colors. And when it's converted into a binary code, then it's just on and off. That's all it is. It's just a pattern of on and off. That's what the digital information is. And so when electricity is going down the wire, of course electricity doesn't go down the wire, right? I mean, it's just a changing of potentials, and that pattern is copied across. Nothing moves down the wire. Electricity doesn't move like water, where it starts at this end and ends up at that end. It's just a shifting in potentials. So that pattern is copied over, and that pattern is repeated at the end. So that simile, the sheet of paper is like our body, right? And our body contains, in some way, information, right? Which is something like information. So I'm not saying that consciousness in Buddhism is exactly just information, right? It's something like it. But consciousness, memories, karma, all of that stuff, right? And that stuff is all transferred. At the other end, you get another sheet of paper. It doesn't actually share one atom in common with the other, but the patterns are recognizably dissimilar. And those patterns are things like your karma, your character tendencies, your memories, and these kinds of things. The things that make you distinctly you, the things that make this fax sheet of paper different from another fax sheet of paper. Okay? So that's the idea of how rebirth works in Buddhism. Now, What the Buddha is doing when he's giving that explanation is he's giving what is essentially a rational explanation of rebirth. It's an explanation that does not involve any metaphysical entities. That's the point. It's explained purely in terms of consciousness. That means to say purely in terms of the things that you can observe here and now. That's the point. So he's not invoking any specific kind of special metaphysical entity like an Atman or a spirit or something like that, which is going to transfer from one place to the other. Okay? So just as, you know, to a caveman would come along and they'd see this fax coming in going at the other end, I mean, it would be magic to them, right? Because they don't understand how those energies work, right? So the Buddha is looking at this in terms of that, those transfers of energy. And let me say that even though, you know, obviously that's a modern simile, right? But the similes that's given in the ancient Buddhist texts are not too dissimilar to that. For example, in the Visuddhimagga, it gives a simile of like a seal which is stamped in wax, right? It's a similar kind of idea for the technology of the same time, that you have an image or a pattern on the seal which is then stamped into the wax, but the matter, the material of the seal doesn't go into the wax. So this is the idea. Now, in terms of one thing that we need to do, one thing which I believe is badly misconstrued by secularist Buddhists, is that they do not acknowledge the fact that this is not a metaphysical theory. It's a purely rational and empirical theory. Now, the fact that it's a purely rational and empirical theory doesn't mean it's true, okay? But it does mean that we don't have to invoke any special metaphysical entities in order to explain it. It may be true, it may be false. Why, if we believe that it's true, why do we believe it's true? Well, we believe it's true because of the testimony of the Buddha, right? So I may not be able to see my past lives or my future lives or that kind of thing, but the Buddha said he could. Everything of the Buddhas that I have been able to test has worked out pretty well so far. Yeah? And so I think he's pretty reliable. Now, this doesn't mean he's necessarily 100% true, and if you want to be skeptical about that, that's fine, right? But it's not unreasonable to say that somebody has been reliable, therefore I trust him in this, even though I don't know it myself. It's not like a devotion to a blind faith or something like that. It's a rational and a reasonable sense sort of faith. In addition to that, then we can see or investigate rebirth through various cases of rebirth, which have been subject to a reasonable amount of study in the present day. And if you're not familiar with the works of Ian Stevenson, then I urge you to have a look it up and read some of those things. Now, allow me to ask in this room here today, and please don't feel free to not respond if you don't want to, but has anybody here had some kind of experience of their past lives? A memory of them, or do they know somebody, or do they maybe child experience or something like that? So, okay, yeah? So we've got about four or something people here. So maybe on the last day, if anyone's interested, we could discuss those experiences and see what they are. And this is kind of normal, right? In random groups that I've been in, there's usually a few people who will have some kind of experience. In fact, in one group I asked in Canberra, one of the ladies, actually the family had been studied by Professor Stevenson in Sri Lanka. So this is not that unusual. Right? I mean, sure, there's probably a filtering effect to some extent, right? I mean, we're probably getting a few slightly higher kind of weirdo quotient of people showing up here in the retreat. Okay? Probably. Right? But it's not at all unusual, right? And in a random sampling of people like this, you usually find a few people who've had these kinds of experiences. So, there's one of, I think, in Stevenson's studies where they did that. He was in a car driving along with one of his assistants and they were arguing about this. So how common is this kind of experience? And they said, well, let's test it. They stopped off at a cafe or a roadhouse and just sort of went in there and just sort of spoke to the people there and said, has anyone had this kind of experience? And one of the families like, oh yeah, my younger brother says he can remember things from past lives. So I think it's actually much more common than we imagine. So now maybe all of those people are wrong. And there's some very kind of powerful stories if you go into them. It's not just people having a vague memory, but one of the things that Professor Stevenson noticed and studied at great depth was that there is sometimes like a physical or a biological sign which links up with something from a past life. Okay, and so a classic example of a Stevenson type situation would be something like, and I'm just vague memory of one of his stories, was that somebody had a birthmark on their chest. And then they recollected their past life in a particular place, and they went there, they managed to locate it with their families, and they went there to see, and they could remember the place and remember the names of the people, and they showed the photograph of the dead person, and the dead person had been shot and had a bullet wound in their chest in that exact spot. And again, so if that happens, coincidence, sure, but when it happens a few thousand times, you start to think maybe there's something to it. So this is one of the reasons that we have for believing this. One is the authority of the Buddha, second the various research that's been done, and the last one, of course, is if you can realize it for yourself. And if you're skeptical about it, it's okay. Take the attitude of inquiry. I mean, it's an interesting problem, right? It's an interesting problem. See, the thing is that from a secularist point of view, it's like, well, you can't prove that there's such a thing as rebirth. Fine, I accept that. But the secularist can't prove that consciousness arises from pure matter. This also is just a hypothesis. How do we know that? No one's actually done it. So let's, you know, take it as something which is worth inquiring and worth considering. These are important and interesting questions, right? Let's have a look at them and see what's going on. And maybe we can learn something. Who knows? We might find out that there's a bit of truth to both positions, and that we all have something to learn from each other. All right. How do you suggest? I was wondering how we're going for time. How do you suggest that we deal with ourselves if we feel in some ways egotistical and superior? Oh my God, thank you. I know it's wrong to feel this way. No, it's not. But I don't know how to work with myself. Okay, don't worry about it. Oh my good, thank you for coming out and saying that you feel like you're better than everybody else. Yeah? I mean, plain fact is that the very fact that you say that you think that you're better than everyone else means you probably are better than everyone else, because everybody else thinks that they're better than everyone else, but they'd never say it. Right? So since the Buddha said there's three kinds of conceits: the conceit that I'm better than everyone, the conceit that I'm worse than everyone, and the conceit that I'm the same as everyone. See, you thought the problem was hard beforehand, right? Now you got real problems, right? I can't even be worse than anybody. I can't be the same. So the problem is not thinking feelings of superiority. The problem is comparing yourself to others. I've actually been thinking about this a lot. And thinking about this problem of conceit, because I think it sort of underlies in subtle ways, underlies a lot of the kind of the things that we do. Well, speaking purely hypothetically, of course. I don't want to get into it too much, but just to say that really is a good sign. The fact that you can ask about it probably means that it's not such a big problem. The fact that you personally are kind of worried about it means that it's probably not such a big problem. So the main thing is to just reflect on it and be aware of it. Watch how it's playing out, and just see how it plays out in the thought patterns and your attitudes and your beliefs and your values. And just remember, you know, remember to do a lot of compassion practices, right? Just always kind of put yourself into the other person's shoes and say, what's it like for them? Yeah. And look, maybe it is the case that you're better, right? I mean, people are better at different things and so on than others, right? So if you're better than somebody at something else, then give them a hand. There's nothing wrong with being better. Yeah. All right. When in practice is a good time to start contemplating death? Right now. How do you know when the time is right? When you're awake.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. Always good. Contemplating death is always good. Can you please talk about body contemplation, the importance of it, how to practice it? You guys are asking like these really full-on questions. How can it help when dealing with sensual desires like lust, etc.? Oh my God. Okay, so body contemplation. So because you're asking a question about lust, then I guess that you're talking about the practice of the observance of the parts of the body. So again, for those, I know there's a few people here who are kind of new to Buddhism, probably not so familiar with all the different kind of things, so I'll just give a little bit of background to this one. So in the beginning of the retreat, I emphasized a lot about mindfulness of the body, like being awareness of your postures and these kinds of things. And this is the foundation for all Buddhist meditation. So the basic teaching on meditation the Buddha gave is called Satipatthana, is the different kinds of mindfulness meditation, and the first one of those is the contemplation of the body. Okay, so it's the foundation of all forms of Buddhist meditation. Now the contemplation of the body can take many different forms. Right? There's a lot of different meditations which are mentioned there. One of them we've seen before is the contemplation of death. Right, so it's awareness that your body is impermanent. Another one we've been doing is the breath meditation. Right, so breath meditation is like the complement of the meditation on death. Right, so breath is the force of life. So you're contemplating that. So this is giving an idea that in these body contemplations we're looking at different aspects of what this body is. And so the point is that you're getting grounded in this physical reality, and this is the basis for our meditation. This is what stops our meditation from being kind of too airy-fairy, too kind of abstract and spiritual. Get grounded in this reality of this body. So there are other forms of body contemplation which we haven't talked about so far. Some of them, there's the meditation on postures, which we have talked about a little bit. There is meditation on elements. There's a meditation on the different parts of the body. And there are other things as well. For example, there's meditations on food, right? So different kinds of things that you can do, one of those meditations is a meditation which is about what's called the 32 parts of the body, and in that meditation, essentially you go through the different parts of the body: head, hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin are the first five, and you just when you meditate, you imagine these or you feel these, and you can even like sort of like peel them off in your mind, right? So you can peel off your hair and peel off your skin and put it in a pile next to you, right? And do these kind of different imaginative exercises. And so one of the things that this is helping us to do is to help us to deal with our attachment to our body. Because usually when we get attached to bodies, we only get attached to what's on the outside. Usually what's on the inside is not featured on the front of fashion magazines, shall we say. Right? So we get distracted by these appearance and by the surface and by what's on the skin. Of course, this is like a really important topic, and it's a very interesting topic in our day, because our day has become perhaps even more than ever in the past been really fascinated and captured by the appearance of things, right? I mean, we live in the Instagram age, we live in the Kardashian age. We live in the age of appearance and plastic surgery, and where girls and women are being judged by their appearance to a ridiculous degree. And so this is all this kind of obsession with surfaces, and it's kind of been, it's almost been like this tendency is like exaggerated by the digital medium, because the digital medium only captures surfaces, right? I mean, the camera only captures the light that bounces off a person, that's it. So somehow you're almost the whole kind of organic reality of a person that you encounter when you meet them is kind of stripped away, and all you see is that surface. So I think it's like hyper sort of overdriven, that tendency of the mind. So what we do with this meditation on the parts of the body is we take it apart so that we don't get trapped into that. And I mean, it's an interesting kind of it's an interesting dynamic, because the surfaces that see from an inner point of view, then you can see, well, I get like distracted, or you can see that you get like you know, attracted or repelled or get caught up in these different kinds of things. But it's not just the way that we get like caught up in an external object, right? So the gaze from one person to get caught up in another person, but it's also the fact that you get caught up in everybody else's gaze, right? So you're internalizing how other people are seeing you, yeah? And this is creating a distinct sense of self and create and shaping what your sense of self can be. This is talked about a lot by Carol Gilligan. She wrote a very beautiful book called The Birth of Pleasure, and she talked about how this played out. There you go, make a mark on your list there. How this played out in the myth of Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and how she was basically a prisoner of how everybody was worshipping her because of her beauty. Anyway, very, very beautiful book and very well worth looking out for. Okay, so yes, contemplation of the body is useful for that kind of thing. So I mean, typically, contemplation of the body in that kind of way is felt to be more of a monastic thing, right? So you do that because we're living a celibate life, so we have to sort of deal with the feelings that we have and sexual desire and these kinds of things. But of course, it's not just us that has to deal with that, but everyone has to deal with it, actually, right? I mean, you know, people, you want to be in a relationship, but you don't want to be unfaithful, or you don't want to be distracted, or whatever. So having some kind of moderation is really important for everyone. Okay, what is the difference between citta and vijnana? It's a very geeky question. Do I want to answer a geeky question? What's the difference between citta and vijnana? And mano, you have to put in there as well, because so these are different Pali words for the mind. Okay, Pali is very rich in words for the mind and psychological phenomena, and in Buddhist texts, the three most commonly used words for these things are citta, vijnana, and mano. Now, all of those words are actually basically just synonyms, right? They're basically just synonyms, and in many cases they can just be interchanged, right? So there's no kind of fundamental difference from one to the other. However, there is a bit of a difference in usage, okay? A bit of a different, maybe a different connotation. So think about words like, say, car and vehicle and automobile, right? They're basically the synonyms, but in some cases you might tend to use one rather than the other, right? But something like that. So the word citta, which often translated as mind or heart, citta is used very broadly in many contexts to mean mind or thought or idea or all kinds of things. But when it's used in a doctrinal context, it is almost always in the context of the fourth noble truth. There's the practice. So the citta is to be developed. That's why we speak of citta bhavana, right? It's something that we develop through the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's very close in meaning to the idea of samadhi. Okay? So citta is the mind that we develop for samadhi in the practice of the Eightfold Path. Vijnana, we normally translate as consciousness. And so vijnana has a specialized sense of just meaning the awareness of something. But again, vijnana can be used much more generally than that. It has many different meanings. But typically it's used in that way, and when it's used in that way, it most belongs to the first noble truth. And vijnana is to be understood. Okay? The noble truth of suffering. Right? And mano has a strong sense of activity to it. Right, so it's the mind in its active sense. So it's closely associated with ideas like intention and choice and causality. And so in that way it's related to the second noble truth, the origin of suffering. Yeah? So each of these terms, again, they're basically synonyms, but they tend to be featured in different, slightly different contexts. Yeah? So the vijnana is in context of the first noble truth of suffering, and therefore is to be fully known. Mano tends to be associated with the second noble truth, the origin of suffering, in the sense of causality of things. An obvious example being the first line of the Dhammapada, Manopubhangama Dhamma, mind is the forerunner of all things. So it's mind is a creative power, creator of things. And citta is the mind which is developed through meditation and belongs to the fourth noble truth, Bhavetabha. Right? You heard it first here, folks. Alright, what does progress look like on the Buddhist path? Is it struggle or when everything aligns? Oh, when everything aligns, that one. Yeah, that's what progress looks like on the Buddhist path. Everything sort of becomes smooth and natural and normal, and you're like, ah, that's what I was meant to be doing all the whole time. And it's like this kind of point in your meditation, you're like, oh yeah, actually, like, just do what, just like, oh, just watch the breath. Oh right, yeah, I've been sitting here for like 2 days and haven't actually done that yet. And now when you actually do that, this is what happens. Oh, you watch your breath, your mind gets happy and you become peaceful. Oh right. And you spend your whole time like not actually doing it. You spend your whole time thinking about how you should be doing it. Right? So this is what progress looks like on the Buddhist path, is when it just becomes natural. It just becomes what you do. Not sure if we should wrap up. We've got a few more. I'll see if I can go through a few more. But I want to do justice to people's questions, because people ask them for a sincere reason. Okay, so what if any are the benefits of following one tradition of Buddhism versus another, or a combination of traditions such as Theravada or Mahayana? I don't know. To be honest, I don't know very much, because I've just followed the Buddha's teachings. So I've never really, especially with Mahayana, I'm not very that familiar with it. I mean, I've got a general familiarity with it. I mean, from what I can tell, in terms of the practitioners that I know, I mean, I know a lot of my good friends are long-term Mahayana practitioners, and they seem like good people. And when we talk about Dhamma, we seem to sort of share an understanding of things. So I don't know, it doesn't seem to be all that different to me. One thing that I would bear in mind, though, is I think we need to really stop thinking in terms of traditions. Like, people keep on telling me that I'm Theravadan. Just for the record, I haven't called myself a Theravadan for nearly 20 years. I think of myself as being a monk who tries to follow the Buddha's path, that's all. I mean, my ordination lineage, yes, comes through a Theravadan tradition, and I'm grateful for everything that I've got from that. So it's not a problem with it, but it's just not what matters to me. What matters to me is what the Buddha taught, and trying to live that and practice that in my life. And I see people doing that wherever I am. And one of the things that I've really noticed is that if you listen to Dhamma teachings, and if you listen to Dhamma teachings from people in different schools and so on, then you can hear really bad teachings from people in different schools and different traditions. I don't think any tradition has a monopoly on that. No one has a monopoly on scandals with badly behaved teachers. No school has a monopoly on financial corruption. Or any of these kinds of things. But also no school has a monopoly on wisdom or on compassion. And if you listen to the Dalai Lama talking about the Four Noble Truths, it basically sounds like anybody else talking about the Four Noble Truths, or any other wise teacher, Theravadan teacher, talking about the Four Noble Truths. When I was in Sydney, many of you, I think, have been known something of the Dhamma Drum tradition. When I was early in Sydney, Master Sheng Yen came and gave a talk, and at that time I wasn't that familiar with the Dhamma Drum tradition, and we just went along and heard his talk, and he talked about going for refuge, taking the five precepts, contentment, breath meditation, contemplating impermanence, finding freedom. It's basically exactly the same as you might hear a Dhamma talk from a Theravadan. Now, I'm sure not all of his talks were like that, obviously, but that's what I heard. So what it seems to me is that within all of the different Buddhist traditions is that the wisdom of the Buddha has been passed down, and those within those traditions who have the wisdom are able to understand that and to apply that, and that's kind of our job, is to transmit it, and that's what matters. and not whether you belong to one school or another. For those of you who are interested in historical study, there's there's very few scholars who've really looked at it in this way, but there's an interesting scholar called David Kalapahana who wrote a book on, it was called The History of Indian Buddhism or something like that. Anyway, David Kalapahana was one of the very, very few scholars or philosophers in modern Buddhist scholarship who really kind of mastered the different languages and the different schools, different philosophical texts in all the different schools. And towards the end of his life, he developed this approach. Rather than looking at what school somebody's coming from, you look at what they're actually saying. I mean, it sounds radical, right? But that's what he said. He said, well, there's a particular treatise or a particular text or a particular passage. What is it actually saying? Rather than thinking of it as a representation of a school. Because these are things that are actually created by people. And people aren't just templates, which are sort of stamped out by a particular school identity, right? They're actually individuals. And he said, well, actually, within these different schools, there's different people with different ideas who think and who talk and who teach in different ways. And he showed by studying, in quite depth and quite a lot of detail, that within these different teachers, he looked at Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, Dignaga, Moggaliputta, and various others, that all of them in some way were looking into some teaching that's found in the suttas and drawing out and then exploring the implications of that in these different ways. And so to me, that was a really inspiring approach, and that's something that to me, that's how I see myself. So don't worry too much about the questions of traditions. Worry more about being a good person. How does one go about finding the balance between accepting what is, karma, and developing motivation to wanting to help others or change the world for the better? How do you find the balance? Don't think of it as a balance, because a balance means like a bit more of one and a bit less of the other. Right? Think about it that the more fully that you accept the way that the world is, then the more meaningfully you'll be able to change it. These things are not separate. If you're thinking about it as a balance between one and the other, you're still thinking about it as a zero-sum game. Some are going to win and some are going to lose. Either I'm going to be helping or I'm not going to be helping. Right? It's one or the other. But then it's not a zero-sum game. Yeah? It's not how the world works. Yeah? The more that you let go and the more that you are free from your concerns about how the world is, the more you will change the world. I mean, don't take it on my say-so. Think about the Buddha. Right? I mean, who has changed the world more than the Buddha? Seriously. 2,500 years later, and his teachings still has such an incredible effect. Why? Because he let go of everything, and because that gave him the wisdom to be able to say these words and these teachings that are still so intensely human and so intensely meaningful all these years later. Okay. What is the role or practice of bodhisattva practice beliefs in the forest tradition? The teachings on benefiting self versus others. Interesting question. Again, for those who you may not know too much of the background, in according to the according to commonly received knowledge, the bodhisattva path is a Mahayana thing, and Theravada doesn't have a bodhisattva path. Actually, this is untrue. The bodhisattva path is very prominent within Theravada Buddhism. It's not found, incidentally, in early Buddhism, but it is found in Theravada Buddhism, one of the main doctrinal differences between early Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism. But within the Thai forest tradition, the bodhisattva doctrine is normally kind of an accepted part of that teaching. And the practice of several of the senior most teachers in the Thai forest tradition was, according to legend that's been passed down on the oral tradition among the forest monks of Thailand, that they reached a blockage in their practice. And this was, I think, Ajahn Sao and Ajahn Mun, if I remember correctly, a long time ago heard this. They reached a blockage in their practice, and then when they recollected in their past lives that they had made bodhisattva vows in their past lives, And at that point, they relinquished those bodhisattva vows and became enlightened in this lifetime. That's what I heard. I can't confirm it if it's not true. You heard the same thing? May be true. I'm not sure. Right, yeah. Yeah. So this is what they say. I mean, look, these things get so wrapped up in legend and retelling, I'm not really sure. I didn't know those monks personally. If I knew them, I could have asked, but I didn't. So, but I mean, because of that, and because of this idea, like there's a lot of emphasis in the Thai forest tradition of like, you know, going into seclusion and meditating and all of these kinds of things. And so, if you just sort of read those books and didn't know any better, you think, well, these guys are pretty hardcore, right? They're doing this whole kind of thing, they're not really talking to anyone, they're not really... But actually, it's not like that at all, right? And this is, again, this is like a teacher's tip, is that whenever you read a particular teaching that's located in a particular place, right, the reality of that place is in fact the opposite of what the teaching is. That's why they have to give the teaching. Right? So, and you see, this is really obvious. Like, if I come to this teaching here, right? Here I am in New York. Right? What am I saying? Relax, take it easy, be happy, right? So then you take that and you say, oh, well, New York must have been a really relaxing place, right? I mean, all they ever talk about there is just chilling out and being happy together, right? Yeah? Right? But that's what we do. That's exactly what we do. And when we read these Thai forest masters, and the Thai forest masters are like, yeah, get up and meditate, don't be lazy, go on, practice. And you think, my God, this is so hardcore. But if you go and stay there, monks are like, hey, how's it going? Like, light up not a spliff, but light up a cigarette. They're not smoking joints, but they are smoking tobacco. And it's very relaxed, sorry? Right, drinking Red Bulls, right? Ajahn Mahabua's main sponsor was Red Bull, right? And the culture in those areas, people are very relaxed, very take it easy, you know, it's a rural culture, you know, and so the teachers have to fire them up, right, get them going, you know, put energy in. So you teach the opposite of what's actually found there. This is a kind of a general principle. So, you know, with that whole kind of thing, I mean, it's really interesting to note how the forest monasteries in particular, like monasteries in general, but my experiences with the forest monasteries in particular are closely associated with a major development and flourishing of the villages and the communities near who they live. And this is generally true of most or all of the forest monasteries. It was very, very stark for me when I lived in the north of Thailand. I spent a year staying in a hut by myself. And this was the hut where they built the walking path for me, so it's the same place. And that hut was actually in between two villages. And so I used to go for pindabata or alms round to one or other of the two villages. And, you know, here we are in the middle of northern Thailand, and just these two small villages, roughly the same size and that kind of thing. But it was a completely different experience going to each village. One village I would go and I'd get a few lumps of sticky rice and maybe a banana if I'm lucky. The other village I'd go and my hands would be like cut with these red lines from carrying these heavy bags. My back would be sore and I'd have to sort of try and make some stops to try and give away all my food before I went back because I got so much. Right. What's the difference? Well, at that village there was a forest monastery. And the forest monk in that monastery would work with the villagers and help them and educate them and create a community spirit and create a love of Dhamma and create a love of sharing and giving. And the whole vibe of that village was totally different. It's not just the amount of food they gave. There was a joy. There was a happiness to it. You could just feel it. And you go to the other village and there's somehow kind of a dead feeling to it. Like it's just not a really nice feeling. So to me, that's my experience. And so this happens on a small scale all over Thailand in all of those monasteries, but also happens on a larger scale. And I mentioned before Ajahn Mahabua, towards the end of his life, he did an incredible amount of charity work, and he was building all of these hospitals and all of these animal care, animal shelters, and an incredible amount of things that he did. And he raised all of this money. You go to his monastery, and there's nothing there. It's just these same crappy wooden huts that he had in the past. He didn't spend any money on his monastery at all. And even the hall, the sala in the monastery, was still here, just a small wooden sala, small wooden hall. And it's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous, right? There's like hundreds of people coming every day to give food. And in this tiny little place, and the monks are like running around trying to organize things. And I do mean like literally running. And when we went there, they had recently built a concrete understory to the hut, to the main hall, the main sala. And the story was that they so desperately needed this, and Ajahn Mahabua refused to make it, that they got someone to invite him down to Bangkok for a couple of weeks, and then they built it while he was away. And waited until he just sort of got back and didn't say anything. And so he really lived that. He really lived that simplicity. And even though he's such a famous monk towards the end of his life and had so much money coming through and all of it went out, like all of it. Yeah? And that, to me, is where you see that kind of distinction. To me, again, that distinction between the arahant or bodhisattva or whatever, I don't know, really. Who's arahant, who's a bodhisattva? I don't know. If you're a good person, that matters. If you're kind, that matters. If you're free, that matters. You know? Ajahn Mahabua is supposed to be an arahant. When he'd come back from his arms round, you see the delight in his face when his dogs would leap up and start licking him. Is that attachment? I don't know. It's hella cute, though. All right. Where does God fit into Buddhist practice? Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I'm aware, God is most welcome to come and join the retreat. Yeah? Yeah? Fine? Yeah, we got... And... yeah, we don't have anything against any gods wanting to come and practice with us, so that's fine. So, Buddhism is not a religion of salvation, so we're not looking to a god or anything like that to save us. Of course, Buddhism, you know, grew up in India where there's, you know, lots of gods for everything all the time. So the Buddhism, generally speaking, again, I don't want to go into too much detail, but generally speaking, Buddhism has a kind of fairly lackadaisical attitude to kind of local beliefs and gods and things like that. Like, it's okay, you want to believe in this, like you go to Thailand, they have the spirit worship houses, that's fine, you put a bit of rice in them and so on. And it's like, it's all right. You know, even like in Sri Lanka, they have the Devalas and they have their kind of festivals and they go and give offerings to the gods and things. It's okay. You know, but the main point is that they can't save you, right? I mean, if you want to ask for help in passing your exam or something like that, that's fine. But you're going to save yourself because of what you do. Okay, how do you focus on the individual nature of the path without becoming selfish or self-centered? Well, I think we've already discussed that, so I might just leave that. And last one. Is there a point in practice where one should take a break or let go if the practice or meditation path is no longer joyful or peaceful? Or does letting go not apply to the path? See, you're trying to trick me. It's not that easy, right? Not that easy, right? I've been around the block, okay? So, look, in terms of practice and things, sure, it's a good idea to take a break from time to time. You know, you come here, do your retreat for a little while, go away, do something else. Change it up, you know, do this and that. Don't feel like you're sort of obliged to be, you know, going full bore all the time. But having said which, like if you're relating to the path as something which is like a strenuous and difficult thing from which you need a break, then maybe that's the issue, right? Maybe the way that you're walking the path is the issue. Yeah? So, you know, think of the path as being like going for a nice stroll along through a park. Shouldn't be something, oh, when can I get a break from this? Yeah. Just enjoy it. Figure out like why it is that you think about it like that. You know? Actually, the path is very beautiful and very joyful. And, you know, before I came here, last few years, I spent most of my time in Taiwan. 2.5 years staying on an island in Taiwan and just translating suttas. And the only kind of regret I had at the end of that 2.5 years, most of that time I hardly talked to anyone. Like I would do 3 months and I have to go and do my visa in Hong Kong. So I'd have to catch a plane over to Hong Kong and come back again and I'd speak to a few people then. But for the other 3 months I'd hardly speak to anyone. And so much so that if you do it for that long, your voice gets kind of stuck and you quite forget how to speak. And I just loved it so much. And at the end of it, the only kind of regret I had is that I wish there were more suttas. So I could stay there for longer, just keep translating. But I ran out of suttas. Bummer, right? Anyway. Okay, that's it.